Whoa, baby. Traumedy podcast time again. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, friends of all ages, it's a little old me, Kenneth Allen, coming to you live or from your little place in the multiverse. What's happening? What are you doing tonight, today, tomorrow, this evening? You want to hang out? Let's hang out. Get some popcorn. Get your comfortable shoes on, you know, and kick back, because this story is going to blow you right out of those comfortable shoes. I got to tell you, I'm still reeling from this interview. This was so much fun and just really an interesting story. This interview is with Gene Starzensky. He's the director, the filmmaker, the producer, the envisioner of the documentary Freedom House, Street Saviors. Check it out. Go check it out on the internet. Go check it out on YouTube. Like it on Facebook. It's the story of the very first paramedics working in the U.S. Began in Pittsburgh and Oakland, PA, back in 1967, and it was kind of a public outreach, government-funded organization, and Freedom House funded it to get some kind of emergency medicine and paramedicine on the streets, particularly in lower socioeconomic neighborhoods. And it's such an incredible tale. I've never heard it before. I hadn't learned anything about it until I started kind of looking online and I saw a couple trailers for the film. And I said, wait a minute, how has this story never been told before? It's amazing. It's got so much history and just rich, entertaining, educational stories about what medicine, what pre-hospital emergency medicine is all about, and why you set it up in the first place, and what you're hoping to do with it. You're out there just trying to help the public. And yet, I've never heard anything about it. And I kept asking myself, after seeing the previews and reading about it, why have I not heard this? Why have I not heard this tale? Well, that question is definitely brought up in the documentary, and there are several opinions that you may have as to why it hasn't been addressed. And speaking with Gene, it seems like there is a credible amount of resistance that he's had to fight against just to get this story told. I mean, he pushed and pushed. He made this film, he started back in 2001, and mostly funded out of his own pocket. Along the way, as he started talking to people and researching and trying to get it done, he started to make some really good friends in the film industry. You're going to see that he spoke with, you know, just different directors, different producers, and they finally took a shine to his film and said, all right, yeah, I'm willing to put down this. I can do this. This story has to be told. And it really does. It's amazing. Just the story, just the fact that they weren't even recognized as paramedics until into the 80s. And they said, kind of as an afterthought, yeah, well, I guess they were doing the work. And then when you listen to this interview, he, as a paramedic and first aid provider in Pittsburgh, was running into Freedom House medics, and he's realizing not only are they medics, they have the best ambulances, they have the best equipment, they look the best, they were the most professional, and they were doing care that was above and beyond anything that anybody was doing in the U.S. at that time. And so just this entire story is incredible, and you have to see what happens once this program gets going. And then it gets recognized finally by the government, the U.S., the city of Pittsburgh, and then what all the events are that follow that to kind of to see what happens to this, to the program, to the Freedom House program. It's really an interesting, totally enthralling story, and I'm not going to give too much away because you just have to listen to Gene tell it. It's such a great story. And it really, again, it's one of those stories that blows my hair back. And I'm glad that I was able to track him down. And I'm so thankful for him for being so open and honest. So, get out there on the 26th of February, the Roxy. It's playing, I think, 7 o'clock around that point. Get out there. Get your tickets in advance. This film's going crazy. After that, you Washington, D.C. people, it's going directly to Washington. He's going to show it at a film conference there, an EMS conference there. So, get your tickets in advance. I'll see you over there. We'll share some popcorn. Maybe put butter flavoring on it. We can splurge. splurge sounds like a bad, sounds kind of dirty in this term, doesn't it? A little splurge on the popcorn. And wear your sensible shoes there, too. Hey, you can put on something comfortable. Put your loafers on. No, just put on your sneaks. Slip into that darkened room and enjoy a little piece of American history. It's a great film. It's well done, too. I want to mention also that San Francisco Paramedic Association on the 27th of February is having a 24-minute director's little cut of the film that gets more into the technical aspects of the Freedom House project. It talks to the founders and the medics that actually worked on the rig, goes into the protocols, the kind of treatments that they were providing, the kind of patients that they were dealing with. And so it's good for some CMUs, for all you EMTs and paramedics and doctors and nurses. Check it out. Go to the website for SFPA and check out that little film on 27th. But for sure, 26th, I'll see you out there. Roxy. All right? February 26th. It's going to be a great little show. If you want to know more about the project, if you want to know more about the film, go to www.freedomhousedoc.com. Freedom House, D-O-C, as in documentary, .com. And like them on Facebook. Go find it. Sign in. Give them the thumb. All right. Without any further ado, I give you Gene Starzynski. Let me give you a quick run-in. So we're speaking right now with Gene Starzynski. He's the director of the film Freedom House, Street Saviors. It will be playing this February 26th at the Roxy in San Francisco. And then there's going to be a little technical film shown at the San Francisco Paramedic Association on the 27th of February for anybody who wants to go get continuing education credits. You can actually just go and watch the film and speak with Gene there, and you're getting not just some extra credit points, but you're getting an incredible film that tells about the history of the first paramedics in the United States, the amazing story of what they've done, what they did to start off, the kind of the climate in which emergency medicine began in this country, and the politics involved that can almost drive it away before it really gets established. I get everything right there, by the way, Gene? That sounds pretty good. Am I right on the money with the dates and everything?
Well, on the San Francisco Paramedic Association, that Wednesday, February 27th,
yeah,
it's basically, they're going to get CMUs for this. It's
okay.
Actually going to be a class, more or less, about the kind of a little bit of the insight in the history of EMS, and I'm going to show what's never been seen before.
Yeah.
It's a 24-minute first cut, my very first cut from my very first interviews that I did in Pittsburgh with the founders of Freedom House.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them are all passed away now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically a 24-minute piece, and it's a talking heads piece where you're actually going to learn the history of Freedom House them.
That's incredible. Well, whatever. Go. You're getting CMUs. You're getting CEs. It's a fantastic film. Go see it anyway, everybody. What the hell?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So, hey, why don't you just kind of break down really quick what this film is about, you know, and then we'll get more into detail later. But I want to just set this up for everybody.
Well, this film is about Freedom House Enterprises, Freedom House Ambulance Service, which was started in 1967. It was an inner-city ambulance service that ran the Hill District, Oakland, and parts of downtown Pittsburgh. And it was funded through poverty programs of the 60s, you know, like the Johnson Administration Poverty Program.
Right.
And also there was the Manpower Development Act.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a person there, his name was Philip Hallen, who actually was the president of Marique Falk Medical Fund.
Okay.
And he was always involved with the inner city, with the African-American community. And he found out about this money that was coming down that was going to train these African-American people that lived in that inner city called the Hill District that drive huckster wagons, mm-hmm. which was fresh fruits and vegetable trucks throughout the neighborhood.
Right, fruit hucksters, right, right.
And he figured out, he says, well, listen, you know, this area was a very tough area, you know, and you couldn't get a private ambulance company to go in there. In fact, private ambulance companies in those days were mostly run by funeral homes. Wow. They were, you know, like almost like a hearse-type vehicle, you know.
Yeah.
And they had nothing in them, just basically an oxygen bottle. And they did have a gurney, though, where the police ambulances went up in those areas, which went, actually, the police ambulances ran the whole city this way, mm-hmm. was just a van paddy wagon mm-hmm. with a metal
slash
bench.
Hearse. Yeah.
And they put a cot in there, an old army stretcher cot, mm-hmm. and they carried an oxygen bottle, and they didn't even have any lights in the back of it. When they closed the doors, it was pitch black.
Yeah.
So,
right.
And then basically they put you in there, they put you in feet first, mm-hmm. so that your head was towards the back door of the rig. They closed the doors on you. Both guys would sit up front, and then haul ass to the hospital, and hopefully you made it. And the reason you were put in feet first is so that the doctors could come out of the ER and they could pronounce you dead without having you leave the vehicle.
Oh, yeah. I mean, thinking about the funeral home, too, it's like it's got to be reassuring when a hearse picks you up when you're feeling ill. It's like, hey, yeah, they might just take their time, go slow.
You don't have to move you.
It's one-stop shop.
They can piss us on both ends.
That's right. Hey, take the long way around. We're not going to have to even stop at the hospital.
That's right.
That's crazy.
That's right. So what happened really was Phil Hallen, while he was going to college, he got a part-time job working on an ambulance in Syracuse, New York, and that's how he started thinking about maybe, you know, this. They need more medical transportation, at least, to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And then he met with, there was a man by the name of Jim McCoy who ran the Freedom House Enterprises. Just happened, this recently was opened up, and it was on Center Avenue. It was basically a storefront, and they had offices in the back, and they were there to help African Americans with voting registration, and, you know, it could be more or less a community center for them.
Okay.
But they already had an enterprise set up there.
Right, okay.
So that's how Freedom House got its name, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Through that entity.
Freedom House.
Because there's already a business in place. Mm-hmm. So they talked to Jim McCoy, and then Phil Hallen had a friend, Ed Norian, who was like an administrator at Presbyterian Hospital, which is the leading teaching hospital in Pittsburgh during that time. Mm-hmm. Actually, that's where the Salk vaccine came from.
Oh, the polio vaccine. Okay.
Yep.
Right.
And it's a well-renowned hospital. And now it's called UPMC, but University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, but at that time it was called Presbyterian Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And Ed Norian knew of Peter Saffer, this well-renowned anesthesiologist that came from Austria and by way of Baltimore City Hospital. And he actually was one of the founders of CPR. He put the head tilt with the mouth-to-mouth resuscitation part of it.
Okay.
And he also is one of the inventors of the ICUs. And they knew that he was working with the National Academy of Science on the white paper, mm-hmm. you know, the 1966, wow. that, you know, about there was more people dying on the streets of the United States than in the war in Vietnam.
The accidental death, I can't remember. The 1966 paper about, freeway accidents and the need for rapid transport to the hospital and care of patients while they're getting to the hospital. Right, pre-hospital care, basically.
So Saffer was working with them, and so they went to Dr. Saffer about, they proposed this idea of training these African Americans to medical care and to transports. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Saffer said, hey, you know, I'll take it on, because he wanted to showcase CPR. His main objective was to get the care to the person out on the street. He didn't care if it was you carried your own bags or whatever, however you had to do it. He wanted to get the care to the people that needed it.
Right.
You know, instead of them coming to the hospital, get them treated first, then bring them in. So that's how it started, Freedom House Ambulance Service. So all these heads got together and formed this and got it going, it started.
And, I mean, the interesting thing is, you're kind of mentioning it there, is like, we got to get some kind of care to these people. We're not even really sure about what is necessary on the street versus in the hospital. And it kind of led to what, like an expanded scope, I would say, by today's standards for sure. Like what paramedics were taught to do and medications they carry, protocols. It was definitely an expanded scope of practice.
Well, Dr. Saffer actually was working with the National Academy of Science to design ambulances.
Right.
And in the documentary, you'll see the first drawings of the modern-day ambulance.
Incredible.
And where he has the person's head, when putting the person's head in first, and with a bench behind the person's head. He set that up like an anesthesiologist be working on you in the operating room.
Right.
That's how
right.
That's why he has had the seat right next to the person's
head.
Oh,
right, because that's where he would have been in the ER or the OR, right?
He's
standing
at the
head directing.
And then
people.
They had to miniaturize all the equipment to make it portable to put in these ambulances.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's when they went to here, and they went to Laerendal. Laerendal was a toy manufacturer in Norway.
No
Dr. Saffer knew of them, and he went to them to design the Recessive Annie, the doll for training, and he also had them design the first ambulance. In the old days, the ambu bags were black, and you couldn't see if someone was aspirating in the mask.
Wow.
And I don't know if you remember the first Laerendal bags. They were like a clear kind of a greenish tint.
Uh-huh. I do actually remember them from seeing them when my parents would bring them home. Yeah, yeah. I know that teal.
And you had the holes. We had that long extension hose that you lay out, mm-hmm. and then you put the oxygen into the bag, and you only had to run like 1 liter row two to deliver 100% oxygen to a person with that bag.
Huh, yeah.
And I have one of the first guys, I interviewed one of the first guys that actually used that bag that worked at Freedom House after it was designed. But everything you see in an ambulance today was all started because of Freedom House.
I mean, right.
You know?
They set out the prototype for everything. I mean, they literally designed
NICU ambulance.
Right.
Yes,
yeah, mobile intensive care units. Yeah. Were those, by the way, ambu bags, all those BVMs, were they disposable back in the day, or did you actually reuse those?
No. You cleaned them up. You used alcohol, you cleaned the mask, you cleaned everything up.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you used them, of course. I mean, I worked in a hospital, and they were still using Foley catheters were rubber, and they would have to clean them, and then you'd have to wrap them up and then sterilize them, and they use them again.
Sure, you can't let those go to waste. It's insane. A little different time back then, for sure.
Yeah, it definitely was.
Well, you were mentioning to me when we spoke that, you were... Let's talk about you first off, too, because your story, that it kind of dovetails in with when you first saw Freedom House ambulances at the hospital when you were working. What's your story?
Well, my story was, after me spending 2 years in the Marine Corps, I would basically, when I left the Marine Corps, I was a military police officer, and that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a police officer, but, I was only 19 years. I joined the Marine Corps at 17. I got out at 19 years old, and I tried to, I couldn't join up with the police department because you had to be 21 to be a police officer. And, I ran into some friends, and they said, hey, why don't you, I went and took, I went to community college there and took police science, but, I just couldn't hack it because I was already doing police work in the service. I ran, VAST car, visual over speed computers. I set up speed traps with that, and I had radar. I did traffic investigation, and I worked a little bit with criminal investigation detachment under Naval Intelligence.
Wow, that's incredible.
It was a young kid, but they put me undercover a lot because I was really, I was really young.
You were
I used to work at a gate. The main gate, Camp Lejeune, and people, have to stop visitors coming in, and people used to drive up to me and look at me and say, shouldn't you be in school, in high school?
Yeah.
And I look at them and say, no, ma'am, no, sir. I says, I'm a Marine.
Yeah. Semper Fi.
But really, so what happened was we had a part of a highway that ran through the base anybody could go through there. You just had, it was called Sneed's Ferry Gate. You went through the rear gate, and it was a major highway. Went through the base, and a lot of times we had a lot of traffic accidents there.
Oh, okay.
And sometimes we were the first to get there. And, you know, I didn't have any type of medical training, and that's the first time that, you know, I got to work on somebody. You know,
wow,
you take
okay.
your shirt, you did anything that you
right.
could do for them.
Yeah, you ball up a shirt or you make like a yeah. splint out of like, you know, some books or a stick or whatever you got.
Didn't
whatever you
what
have
I was
around
going,
there.
But, you know, I was definitely yeah. scared of blood when I was a kid, and, you know, that got me more, you know, I didn't really give a shit after that.
Right,
you know?
Right. You get acclimated
I had
a little bit
more of a stomach
it.
For it.
Desensitized.
But, yeah, but... when I got out of service, like I said, I went to police science, and I was with a bunch of REAC kids, you know, kids that that's all they wanted to do all their life, and they were in all these clubs and stuff, and, you know, they're teaching me about juvenile offenders and what to do. I don't care, I don't want to know their sociology or what got them there. You know, when I'm going to confront them, I'm going to be worried about whether they have a gun or they're coming after me with a knife or what, you know.
Absolutely.
So basically, I kind of... bail from that schooling, and I ran into some friends, and they said, hey, you know, why don't you get a job in an ambulance that has a red light and a siren on it, you know, at least you'll feel comfortable, you know. I thought,
right.
Well, what the hell. So I went and took some first aid classes, you know, that's all you had to have those days was a standard first aid card.
Okay.
So
yeah.
I went to American, you know, Red Cross and took a standard first aid course, and I went to a company in Pittsburgh, a private ambulance company. I had two ambulances and he mostly, I went to meet with them, and he says, well, I don't hire people. He goes, if I don't know you, he says, I hire people to live around my neighborhood, because when we get a call, he just calls them on the phone, they jump in the ambulance, and they go, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And he goes, well, normally I don't hire anybody. And I might have had a cousin who lived in California. I came out and visited him before then, mm-hmm. and he worked ambulance. So basically, the guy asked me, what's your qualification? I said, well, I worked for Thompson Ambulance Service, which was my cousin's buddy.
Right.
And I gave him this address in Redondo Beach, California, because
yeah.
that's why I told him where I started, where I got trained and everything. And to make a long story short, he hired me, and I had to work with him.
Well, there you go.
And
perfect.
First day, we go to pull the gurney out, and I tell him I don't know how to operate this gurney. We don't have those kind in California.
Oh, boy.
So he basically taught me how to operate the gurney.
Yeah, we just have a different gurney, but yeah, this is new.
Yeah, and because I never thought I'd be working with the owner, you know?
Well,
and,
right.
So I kind of learned as I went, and my cousin and them knew when they got the letter. You know, because there's no internet then, so the people had to, like, either phone call somebody or they had to send a letter or whatever. And he sent a letter down there and went a recommendation on me, and they opened up the letter and they saw that, so they wrote. And one day he came to me, he goes, man, he goes, they gave you a great recommendation. I said, who did? He goes, Thompson Ambulance Service. So my cousin and his buddy wrote this letter all about me. That's how my EMS career started.
Yeah, you got to thank your cousin. That's great. I hope you sent him a case of beer or something, you know.
Saved
my ass. Thanks, buddy. Yeah, you want to see what else was on the resume, on the letter of recommendation too. What else exactly?
But that's
did
how
say?
you learn as you go, and that's how it was in those days.
Well, that's it. You get your foot in the door, and then once you're there, yeah. it's a trial by fire. You're there. You're doing it with the owner, you know, and you perform or you don't. And I mean, that's the best. That's really all you need, though, is a foot in the door, as long as you know what you're doing.
Well, I had a first aid class. It was it. But
and
let me
first
tell you
class.
This. The very first call we went on, I mean, one of the first calls I went on, was we went to this house, and there's two older women there,
yeah.
and there's one old woman sitting in a chair, you know, and the other older woman was saying, Martha, the boys are here, they're going to take care of you, you know.
Yeah.
I went over there, and she was already, kind of rigor was already set in.
Oh,
she was rigid. I couldn't even get her out of that sitting position.
Uh-huh.
We lifted her up, put her on the gurney. She looked like she was, you know, how the legs were up
so
in the
got
air.
Feet
and
up
her
like
back.
A dead cat, yeah.
Yeah, trying good to grief. Put her down and stuff. And, you know, she was gone for a long time. And,
yeah.
You know, I'm in the back of the ambulance, and we're heading under the hospital. And mm-hmm. he yells at me in the back. He goes, well, do something for her. And I look at her and go, what can I do? She's gone,
yeah.
man, you know?
Should have been driven the private ambulance, the other private ambulance slash morgue should have picked her up, yeah.
So I put an oxygen mask on her face, which wasn't going to do anything, but, you know.
It looks good.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. That was the, you know, very first time I ever got to see anybody like that or work on somebody like that, you know?
Holy cow.
But it was something else in those days. That's when I found out about Freedom House, because we'd show up at hospitals just to do, you know, transports. That's what we were mostly doing, was we were going to a hospital and taking someone from the home to the hospital or from the hospital to the home, you know, and no real emergencies, you know. And so basically that's how I started seeing Freedom House, and they'd see them at the, in the ERs. And I look at their rigs, and I saw the sophisticated equipment in there, and I was going, wow, man, this is, you know, these guys are something else. And they wore white uniforms, and but they, you know, back in those days in the 70s, because that's when I was working in the 70s, was, you know, they had high water boots, they had cowboy, some guys had cowboy boots on, they had had their pants all hiked up, they had afros, some didn't, you know. And
right.
They were just, they looked out of place, but, you know, but they wore these white shirts and everything, and I looked inside and I saw the equipment, and I used to tell my partners and stuff, ask them about them, who are these guys, what's the deal? And they go, well, they're nothing but a bunch of hoods, ex-convicts, and they have crap games there at the station, and they roll people in the back of these ambulances. And
yeah,
I kind of knew it wasn't true, because they were trained. They were coming out of Presbyterian Hospital.
Right, so it's a reputable place.
Yeah,
obviously
very reputable.
Doing something,
so,
right.
So after that, you know, later on, after the, I think it was, I don't know, maybe 6 months in the ambulance working for that company, at that private company in Pittsburgh, I got a job working at Southside Hospital in the ER. I started as an orderly in the ER, 3-11-30, and then I moved up to emergency room technician. Yeah. And from there, I learned. That's where I learned everything I know. I mean, basically knew, because you know, it was trial by error, and you know, there was only a doctor, a nurse, an RN, and we had a nurse's aide and me, and we saw about anywhere between 60 to 70 patients a shift.
Jeez, yeah.
And yeah, so that's where I really picked up my knowledge of emergency medicine. In fact, even when I ended up later becoming a paramedic and I was in class and they'd be teaching us about, you know, congestive heart failure, and I'd be going, oh, that was table number 3. I remember that day when I had that CHF in there, you know.
Yeah, I remember.
And I could relate. You know, it was funny because,
You
know, I'm looking at things after the fact, and I'm visualizing it, you know.
It's such a great thing to be able to draw on your previous history or patients. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of students now that just run directly from EMT and they go right into paramedicine, and they have no frame of reference as patients or seeing patients or understanding what specific illnesses look like. And it sounds to me like it was, I mean, there's that connection in your brain. You get that kind of, you get that dopamine surge. It's like, oh, that was Mr. Henderson. Right. The rails with the face and the pitting edema. And it makes it a lot easier. And I think rewarding too.
Yeah. I was doing gastric lavage. I had, all the drug overdoses. I'm the one who pumped your stomach out. Mm-hmm. And after I got done pumping your stomach out, you know what I used to do? I used to take a tablespoon of castor oil and I'd run it down that tube on you. Because you know what that did to you?
I think it would come out the other end too, but
No, well, yeah, it gave you diarrhea for a good week.
Right, yeah.
You can't stop them from taking the drugs, but at least make them feel bad. Maybe they might think about it next time, you know?
That's clever.
Exactly.
Did you think of that yourself, or is that kind of a standing order?
No, the nurse taught me that,
so
this is what you do here, you know? And,
that's genius.
You know, and then the hospital I worked at, on the weekends, we always had different residents would come through the ER to work, you know, the weekend shifts. And I'd get a lot of plastic surgeons and stuff working in there.
Uh-huh.
And I used to have to assist them for suturing, because, you know, they like to make really small little sutures.
Right, sure.
So I'd be the guy with, you know, because I'm actually the one, my job was to set up the trays and everything, clean them and have them all ready for sterilization and lay them out again, you know, and then I'd be there to assist.
Mm-hmm.
So I was the guy, you know, I'd like help them and I'd cut the trim it and all that stuff. But I learned a lot from that. In fact, them, they taught me how to suture. I ended up doing all the drunk and late at night. I think I got the winos and drunks. They let me suture them.
I mean, yeah, somebody's got to do it. It's not a life-threatening illness. Why not?
I didn't do any inside sutures, only the exterior sutures. But,
Well, all right. That's great.
You know, you got good at this, because you'd see someone come in with a laceration And I would know almost immediately whether that's going to need suturing, you know. And I'd have all the different sutures lined up, whether it be floral silk or, you know, or nylon, or if I need some gut for the inside, I'd have it all laid out for them, you know, so they come over. And I would already know when somebody didn't need sutures, you know. And that helped me a lot when I got the job at the studios, because at the studios, you're more like an occupational health nurse.
Right. This is working for commercials.
For that.
This is where I'm sorry. I was just like when you're working in Hollywood and movies and commercials.
That was later. Yes.
Oh, okay.
I went to L.A. when I became a paramedic. Well, we even got to that when I moved to L.A. yet, but we'll get to that. But
sure.
But it gave me a really good rounded background, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, and I'm really glad that I was able to get that training. I came here to California when I became a paramedic. And I worked with firemen, and I watched them almost kill people. You know, they got the 6 months of training, and they think they're bigger than God, and they're not, because they don't have any formal medical training, you know. And they get out there, and they get gun ho and stuff. And you got to sit down, calm down, assess the situation, you know. Look at the patient.
I mean, exactly, and draw on previous experience, which is, you know, what you were doing. And they didn't have that index yet. Yeah, and it, like you said, it can mean the matter of life and death very, very easily. Either you miss something or you're doing something absolutely wrong.
Yeah.
And, you were mentioning a couple of those calls where, I don't know if you want to get into them, but you basically said, look, you're killing this guy. You gotta let me step in here, buddy.
That was the call I was telling you about earlier about the guy who almost killed the patient in the back of our ambulance because we were transporting it for a fire department out here, and how the private company I work for, we lost the contract, which we actually didn't lose the contract because our owner basically told the fire department, we're not transporting anymore. You're lucky my guys don't bring you guys up on charges.
Wow, yeah.
You know?
It's, yeah.
So... let me tell you what, I think medicine, this is my prerogative, I think medicine should always be, emergency medical services should be emergency medical services. Fire department should be fire department. You know, I know they can help with extrication, which is great, but I think they should just stay to being a fireman, period. I don't think they should be involved in medicine, but they do that to save money. Because these guys, I see them all the time, they don't really care about being the medical part of it. Once they get a chance to step up to engineer or above, they leave those jobs immediately.
Yeah,
you know, just like me, I didn't want to be a fireman, you know.
Right.
And you know, after me being when I trained in England and stuff, I didn't want to stick around because I didn't want to be a fireman. That's why I left after I became a paramedic and got into the studio business, because mostly everything out here is departmentalized through the fire department.
It is, and I think there are a lot of people that say, well, I'm going to get trained as a paramedic because there are less people going for firefighter/paramedic jobs than there are fire EMT jobs, and it narrows the market. I become more desirable, and then when I get in, hey, we still got an ambulance crew showing up. All I got to do is basic BLS, and then I'm ready for a fire in case that comes around. But the truth is, there's just not that many fires anymore. And if you don't have that kind of want to help people and that desire to be in, I mean, it's not always blood and guts. It's also picking people up that you've picked up over and over again. It's cleaning somebody up who's soiled themselves. I mean, your Code Browns nobody enjoys, but that is part of the job. That's why you get paid. And I think a lot of people just say, well, I don't do that. I don't do that. I don't clean up shit. But, well, guess what, buddy? That's in your job description. And,
that's right.
You know, and you're right. As soon as there's an opportunity for a lot of people to promote, they do. But also, and I'm actually, you know, being a fire medic myself, you do run into the old guys there that have been firefighters for 15, 20 years, sometimes 30 years still. They're a dying breed. I mean, they're literally a dying breed now, but they still love the job. They love the craft, and they still have that kind of humanity towards their patients that it's such a rarity to see these days. You know, just that really, they get down to their level. They actually talk to the old people. They ask questions that are not just, you know, okay, dear, what I'm going to need you to do right now is jump up on the gurney here. You know, and it's just all this kind of rote conversation that they carry on, and they actually go, I noticed that picture over there. Who is that? Is that your grandkid? You know what I mean? just that kind of humanitarian quality is just, it's lacking in this profession now. And I think you run even more of a risk in paramedic firefighter, because there are a lot of people that say, well, I really want to become a fireman. Or I'm going to become a paramedic so that I can become a fireman because I like the fact that firemen get this many days off. And it's like, what about this job exactly do you like? You like not being there?
Only problem with the 24-hour shifts for medics isn't a good idea. Okay, it's not a good idea for anybody, because I know there's been times that I'd show up and first call would have like 6 in the morning, we'd start 7 in the morning, mm-hmm. and I have to run out on a car accident, mm-hmm. you know,
right,
because rush hour traffic.
Yeah.
And then, you know, maybe we get, an invalid call or something. It could be a diabetic call or maybe chest pains or something. And then we'd be back at lunch. We'd be cooking at the station and getting everything prepared. And the next thing you know, we could bust out another call.
Yep.
I mean, you might get 2 or 3 more calls, but then what happens in the middle of the night, man?
Oh, yeah.
You start getting, a shooting or knifing or stabbing. And then you get back to station, you just close your eyes off, and then by 2 o'clock, the bars are closing. Next thing you know, you got shit happening all over the city, because there's something, big fight went down, or somebody got drunk and crashed, and a bunch of people are pinned in cars and all this stuff. So you get that.
Yep.
So, I mean, you're literally dog tired. There's days that, and then your partner, when I first started, there weren't that many paramedics. So if you're partner, if someone called in sick the next day, you'd have to work 3 days in a row.
It's insane.
So there was days, I'd be taking a shower and, I didn't even know if I still had shampoo in my hair, And, I'd seen partners who yell at you and say, you got to cut the shit short because we got to go, pal. We're going,
Literally cut your shit short. I've had that happen too a few times. Yeah.
I mean, it's not like that all the time, but things like that can happen.
Oh, yeah. I know.
And how many times we were doing CPR on people? I don't know how many times whether it be a trauma victim, the knifing, stabbing, gunshot victim, mm-hmm. that you get there and you're working on them. Next thing you know, they go on cardiac arrest on you. So now you got to go through the ABCs now. You had them on O2, you got to throw the O2 off. Next thing you're doing chest compression. Then you're trying to put cardiac drugs in them, mm-hmm. And then you're running down the gutter lanes of the freeway, and you're, you're pounding on his chest all the way en route.
Yeah.
And the gutter lanes got nothing but you could hit an old peel pipe or broken glass or bottles and all that crap. But that's the only way you can get through there, know?
Yeah, yeah. And you haven't slept in 36 hours.
That's right. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So,
it's like a nightmare.
I like Pittsburgh's program,
okay.
The city of Pittsburgh, uh-huh. because what they do is they work you 8-hour shifts.
Okay.
And they try to put 3 people on a rig. If there's somebody training, they put an extra person on that rig as much as they can. So what you have is you work one steady 8 to 12 or 4 to 12. You might work a month of it, okay?
Okay.
Then you rotate. But then they have a resident. They have a couple of different residents out of Presbyterian where they train doctors. And they put them in Jeeps or SUVs throughout the city in different districts.
Right, right.
So that if anything major goes down, they respond.
Right.
You have a doctor assisting you. Plus, they have roving supervisors driving cars, or they're driving SUVs. They have all the cardiac equipment in their vehicles, the EKGs, the defibrillators. They got all that and trauma equipment. So sometimes they can show up at the house first. And my brother had some heart problems. My brother goes, a guy shows up in a car, comes out with all the equipment, and he's already got me patched in. Yeah. Then the paramedics show up.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's great. And there are in San Francisco, and there's a couple other places that have it. Well, I think most places in the North County do, North California. But yeah, rescue medics is what we call them.
You've got professional medics, and that's all you have showing up in your house. You don't have to have a fire engine showing up, the police car showing up, mm-hmm. and all these people stomping through your house. How many times I've gone into a house working on a person for chest pains? He's never called an ambulance before in his life. And all of a sudden, all these firemen come in his house. And he's going, is my house on fire, too? What's going on?
Yeah,
and he smells
doesn't understand
all your smoke coming out of your turnouts because they're left over from there.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
your ambulance smells like a big old fire, like a bonfire, because you got your turnout hanging in the back
there,
Sure.
Yeah, well, and it's been becoming more of an issue. Ironically, it's like, why are all of these fire engines showing up on this call? And by the way, if there is a fire, we're going to need all of these. So why are they,
Extra manpower. This way you don't need extra manpower because you got roving supervisors.
It would be great. You know, it always comes down to money, and it comes down to, you know, and I do feel there is something. We've gone ALS and fire engines now. They're looking to go back to BLS, and I just have a hesitation into devolving rather than progressing forward. This like what you're saying, if you had a rescue captain, or we're trying some things in San Jose, actually, that or San Jose Fire's trying to do like squads, where it's basically like, you know, the Roy and Johnny and Roy type thing, where it's a two-man operation, and they show up first because they're just more proximal to the call, stabilize or start ALS, and then when the ambulance shows up. So basically what you're saying, instead it would be a two-man company rather than just a one person showing up. And it makes a lot of sense to do it that way, you know, but like again, like what I think is you have ALS going right now. Why go back to BLS? Just to save money? And are the taxpayers of the city aware that you're actually taking away their care?
Well, see, with me, my philosophy from being an EMS 41 years,
yeah,
my philosophy is to have stationed where they're needed, not just necessarily firehouses. The medics would be stationed in areas mm-hmm. throughout the city where the majority of calls are coming through, where they can get their first response. They're having problems in L.A. with response times.
Right.
Where the best response times to come out of these areas. Plus, I would rotate them through every single hospital, ER. Mm-hmm. By doing that, they'd be based there, like Freedom Hospital.
Oh, okay.
They get to know the people in the ER. They're retraining in the ER. They're keeping their skills up, and you rotate them through there. Mm-hmm. And there's extra manpower help in the ER for them.
Right.
Plus, when they call in on a radio, the doctor knows you one by one,
exactly.
And knows what your abilities are and what you're comfortable with.
Right. Right. And you know what's going to happen to this patient once you get them into the ER. What's going to happen? What's the continuum of care going to be?
Well, plus the doctor knows how confident you are.
Right.
And they might let you do other procedures outside your scope if you have to.
Exactly. Like they're doing for you. I mean, basically, they knew you were confident enough to start suturing. So they, you know, they say, okay, well, Gene's got this guy. All right, why don't you go ahead and do this, this, and this, push this drug and do a cut down. You know, might as well. You know they can trust you. And you're operating under their license anyway, right?
Yep.
I mean, it'd be like a medical director type situation. So, yeah, that's a really interesting idea. Is anybody doing that right now?
No, I this way. If I ever ran an EMS system, that's what I would do. If I was a public safety director, if I ran an EMS system, that's what I would basically be doing, because they would love it. The ER would have extra manpower there, mm-hmm. and plus they get to know you one to one, and plus you're based. I mean, well, I would rotate the crews too, not necessary,
sure.
because like I said, I told you I got crews where they're really needed for response times. But say that one's working at a firehouse today, mm-hmm. I would shift them up so they all have a chance to rotate through the hospital ER.
Yeah,
that ambulance would be based right at that hospital, throughout the city. Not only that, you wouldn't be based at just one hospital. You'd be based at different hospitals throughout the city, so they get to really know you at all those bases.
Sure. Right. I mean, you make a name for yourself, or, you know, you're infamous. Oh, Jesus, these guys are coming, you know. But it's certainly a good idea. I mean,
plus, any single guy who's a medic needs a lot of women in the hospital. I'll tell you that.
There you go.
I did when I worked at the hospital.
Damn it. Boy, you're speaking my language, Gene. That's genius. We were just talking about
that. You don't have to sit around with a bunch of mopey guys around the firehouse watching TV. You know?
Yeah, this is ridiculous. Yeah, I jump at a chance to go transport to the hospital. Always, every time.
I met my first wife at the hospital. She was the x-ray tech.
There you go.
We used to share the dark room together. I had to bring a patient up. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not going to ask what you were x-raying behind closed doors. That's great. I mean, yeah, you kind of mentioned it before. Like, it just reminded me of it because you're saying the doctors were, you know, they were allowing you to do other scope, higher scope of practice. But you kind of mentioned when you had a family emergency, and speaking about what Freedom House ambulances were equipped with, the fact that the police showed up at your house and said, "Hey, you know more than we do. Here's the med bag. Get in the back of the paddy wagon and treat this patient." I mean, I think it bears shedding some light on, like, just...
Yeah, I know. 1973. This is 1973.
Yeah.
You know, Freedom House has been in existence since 67. All right. It's 73, and I'm working in the hospital ER. It's my day off, so I go fishing with my girlfriend. I catch this long, big-ass carp, and I decided to bring it home because I didn't want to think it was a carp. I wanted to show it to my dad. He was sleeping on the sofa because he had to work a night shift at the mill, steel mill. He comes in the kitchen, sees the fish, tells me it's nothing but a carp. Go dump it at the river. Yeah. So next thing I know, I hear my girlfriend come over, and she says, your dad, take a look. So I run in there, and he's having a seizure.
Yeah.
So, wow. You know, and he happened to be, he was eating something at the table earlier, so there was a spoon there. So first thing I did was I grabbed that spoon, you know, and shoved him and threw him on his side and put that spoon in his mouth to keep his airway open so he didn't swallow his tongue.
Yeah.
And next thing I know, he stops breathing on me. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to yell at her to call for an ambulance. And at those days, there's no 911. You had to call an operator, and then they transport for you and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So lucky she was there, because she got on the phone. I'm working on my dad. He stops breathing. I start resuscitating. I start mopping him out. He starts breathing again. Mm. In the meantime, this is like 3:30, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The paddy wagon shows up at my house. Two police officers come in. They recognize me from the ER.
Mm-hmm.
So they bring the oxygen in, they throw it at my feet, you know. And so I put no two on my dad, you know, stuff. And they bring in that army cot. Yeah. They put him on the army cot. They bring him and throw him in the back of the ambulance again.
Mm-hmm.
And I jump in the back, and they close the doors. That's why I know how it is back there, you know. I did have a little thing once when I was very, very, very young when they hauled me in the back of there for other reasons. But it wasn't medical.
Yeah, no. And you may not remember it anyway, hopefully.
Yeah, so they slammed the door shut, and it's pitch black. This is in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And they posted up front. And so I end up at the ER. I, you know, pick up the army litter, and they put it on a hospital gurney. We come through the doors. It's my crew working.
Oh, man.
So they look at me. I look at them and says, this is my dad. So they jumped all over and worked on him. But that gives you an idea, you know.
Just
that
the dichotomy.
1973,
yeah.
You know, if it wasn't I was there, who knows what would have happened.
Oh, my God. I mean, that's got to be traumatizing. So, I mean, and that's the thing. So Freedom House is operating. It's got this huge scope of practice. It's got cutting-edge equipment, ambulances. It's got a great fleet. And, I mean, it already has an established persona in the city. It's basically running in the inner city as well. And then there's what the city shows off. Basically, they have a couple days to show off the EMS system in Pittsburgh, and they kind of highlight Freedom House, right? As this amazing, new program that's bringing all this pre-hospital care to the masses. And
well, in 1975,
okay.
Caroline came aboard Freedom House. Nancy Caroline was a resident. Mm-hmm. Training at Presbyterian Hospital. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Safford didn't have enough time to spend with Freedom House, so he assigned Nancy to it. Nancy was actually an anesthesiologist resident. Mm-hmm. And he put Nancy in charge of Freedom House. And Nancy helped to bring Freedom House every bit of advanced life support.
Right.
And she rode with the guys. And she would be with them 24, 48 hours without even sleeping.
Wow, okay.
And she devoted herself to Freedom House. So what happened was they put on in 1975, they put on a disaster drill within the city of Pittsburgh,
yep.
Which showcased all Freedom House's skills. They had representatives from all over the world come to this,
mm-hmm.
and also from somewhere in Washington, D.C. that handles... I think it was the Department of Transportation was handling that thing for ambulances. And they came, and they saw how remarkable Freedom House was. In fact, if anybody comes to the documentary, you'll see pictures of that whole disaster drill there.
Wow, okay.
And so this was in 75, but in October 1975, Freedom House got disbanded. That's when the city took over. So what happened was the Freedom House was no longer in existence. So when the Pittsburgh city of Pittsburgh started the paramedic program, they became the number one program under DOT, Department of Transportation,
mm-hmm.
from what they saw from Freedom House.
Because mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
Freedom House wasn't there, so they gave it to Pittsburgh.
Right. So they say, wow, this is incredible. Look what you've done. Here's a bunch of money. And they said, thanks, Freedom House. We can take it from here, basically.
Well, basically, the government, I don't think, knew. You know, they
of course,
this
right.
city, and this is it. And, right. you know, and so they gave the money to them.
Well,
I
just
mean,
a lump
well, not
sum
the money,
the...
but they named the program the number one program under DOT.
Right. So the money goes to the city. The city then decides we're going to start something aside from Freedom House to get this.
Well, the city had it in the works. They weren't letting people know. They, in fact, the attorney, 2 years before Freedom House's demise, the attorney was at a party, and he ran into the Peter Saffer. Not Peter Saffer, but the mayor, Pete Flaherty, at this function. Mm-hmm. And not knowing that he was the, Pete Flaherty, not knowing that this attorney was the attorney for Freedom House, the attorney walked up to Pete Flaherty and said, what do you think of Freedom House? You know, and Pete Flaherty looked at him, because he was white attorney, and said, oh, their days are numbered.
Wow, so it was already in the works.
It was in the works. It was way in the works.
Uh-huh.
And what they were basically doing was they were training Jerry Esposito. We never even got to talk about him, but Jerry Esposito was actually one of the founders of Freedom House, too, that operated an ambulance service in Indiana, Pennsylvania.
Hmm.
And what he was doing was he was bringing his people from Indiana, Pennsylvania. And when Freedom House started opening the doors to bring in more people because they wanted to expand further and further, since Freedom House is the only paramedic training program in the city of Pittsburgh,
mm-hmm.
or in the state of Pennsylvania. Period.
Yeah.
So he started bringing his people from the suburbs, and Freedom House was accepting all these white medics and training them, thinking, well, we're going to really expand now.
All right.
What they were basically doing was one of the medics that they trained actually became, when the city took over, became the public safety director.
Okay.
They had didn't have as much experience as what Freedom House members had.
I mean, it's like the same experience you had dealing with Hollywood. They take the idea, you're the guinea pig is Freedom House. They go, oh, this worked, this didn't. Let's train these people. And, oh, now we have our new director.
Well, the thing of it is, the one of the members that's in the documentary is Walter Brown, and he doesn't cut any beans about it. And he says to this day that, we're talking Pittsburgh, Mississippi here, you know. And it is kind of true because I don't think that would work out really well if there was all these African and more African, like 90% or say 75% African Americans running the city ambulance service there.
Right, right.
You know, I that's what I think. You know, to me, I don't care what color you are, man. If you're there to help me, that's all I want. You know, and if you're giving your best, that's all we should care about. But
yep.
You know, the broad spectrum. But looking at the people who do the voting, you know, for these politicians, and I don't know. We don't know. I don't say it in the documentary that it was racist, but you got to figure it out yourself.
Well, that's good. I think it. By the way, Freedom House playing 26 at the Roxy this year. This February. Everybody, get out there.
Yeah, 7 p.m.
7 p.m. Only 7 p.m.
Yeah, it's only
right.
at 7 p.m.
because
we're only putting that one showing on that evening. And like I say, anybody wants to come to the other event at the San Francisco Paramedic Association, that's at the next day on the 27th.
27th. Okay. Three.
Which is what is that? That's Wednesday, and that's going to go on from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m.
Perfect. And you're speaking at that, right?
I'm speaking at that. You know, more about the history of EMS, and then also about then we're going to put the 24-hour director's cut up there.
Nice.
It's more the talking head piece.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's
mm-hmm.
and then we're going to have a little. Then you know, talk about everything. You know, if they want to hear about being a medic on movie sets, you know, I have that too.
Oh, hell
just
yeah.
I spent 35 years doing that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like you said, it's more or less you're like the old turn of the century doctors just showing up and kind of, what do you need now? You know?
Well, they call you Doc.
Yeah. Well, that's nice. That's a little ego boost.
Yeah, well, the funniest thing was I was doing a show as a Western. I was working a back lot at,
what show?
The back lot of Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
And in fact, it was John Wayne's last movie.
Oh, True Grit.
It was called The Shootist.
Never mind. Okay.
And, you know, and they all got done. They all wrapped up the show. And I had to stick around because I had other shooting going on, because we had like a hospital on that lot where I actually would run it, you know.
Mm-hmm,
that'd be
mm-hmm.
the only one there. Yeah. So I'm like walking up and down this Western Street, and I'm thinking to myself, this is how it is to be a doc of the doc in town.
The old West.
like Doc Holliday. You know?
Yeah. That's
it's all
great.
Stressed and everything, you know. You're walking up and down this dirt streets and stuff.
Tumbleweed rolling through. Yeah.
Exactly.
This is laudanum.
You know what? When you work in that business, you fantasize a lot, you know.
Absolutely, everybody is. You're all in your own dream world. Yeah, your own delusions of grandeur.
That's it.
Did they give you laudanum? Did you have morphine and laudanum to push? That's all I want to know. Were you given the same medication as the doctors were?
Being? No. In fact, when I was when I started work at the studio, my paramedic buddies told me, because that's the other thing in the old days, there wasn't any controls over our drugs.
Yeah, right. You're talking in the late 60s and 70s.
Yeah, in the 70s.
Okay.
We'd use, say we'd go out on a hard call and we'd use a morphine, and we'd come in with the patient, and the nurse would just go, here's the keys to the drug cabinet. You know, you just go under and take what you wanted and you leave, you know. And you know, you check your rig, and next thing you know, you got four or five morphines in there. You got, five or six Demerols, you know. These are all preloads, you know. And
yeah.
I got like eight Valium. So when I was going to work at the studios, the guys are going to me, you got to work this. Take a couple of morphines. They probably can use them over there. No way, man. I'm not taking any of that stuff with me.
Wow. That's great. Yeah. I'm surprised they even stayed in the ambulance that long. But, you know.
Well, we weren't. What's funny is we weren't druggers, you know.
Right. That's true, yeah.
And it's like nobody really cared. And I, you know, I wasn't. And, you know, and we were just a small group back then, you know.
Right.
Everybody knew each other. Like I told you, there was only like maybe four of us or six of us who were all paramedics. So, you know, like I said, one guy got sick, you really had to work 3 days in a row.
Right. And so, I mean, there must have been that kind of... Go ahead.
Well, I was 1975, I was certified in Los Angeles, and I was the 972nd paramedic in LA County.
That's right, yeah. The 972nd.
Wow. 972nd. I went through the very first class at Daniel Freeman Hospital. But the thing of it is, I found out later at continuing education courses that my number was even lower, because I didn't go through the county hospital. I went through, you know, Daniel Freeman Hospital. So the county, what they did was they took our cards off the top when they should have been pulled from the bottom. We found out our numbers would have been 50 points lower.
Damn it. Hey, that's still, you got below a grand. That's impressive.
What's that? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you were below the 1,000 mark. I mean, that's just, that's bragging rights, for sure.
My class was only 11 people.
Wow. And, I mean, was it basically the same kind of protocols as today? I mean, I'm not sure if, you know, are you aware, but I mean, different drugs, different kind of medications, different routes to give them?
Well, you know, I haven't had to use any of that in years.
Yeah, sure.
But when I talk to paramedics, they cut out a lot of things like dopamine. You don't use dopamine anymore for, you know, titrating for titration drips, do you?
We can use it. It's rarely used. We use other...
Aramine, you don't use aramine, right?
Aramine, no.
We used aramine back then. What about phenobarbital for seizures?
We'll use Valium or Ativan or Versed. So it depends
on
the county.
We didn't have Versed. That came out later after me.
Razzle dazzle.
We have phenobarbital. We have Valium.
Yeah.
And what about aminophylline? You still use aminophylline, CHF?
Not pre-hospital. Nope. We don't use it.
Yeah. See, we were using aminophylline and drips.
Yeah. So I mean, it was basically, well, what can we get what are we using in the hospital? They can just have it out there, and we can continue the same treatment once they get in here.
Now, for CHF, do you push morphine as a venous pulling drug?
We can, and they're actually they're really kind of pushing for us to use morphine for it now. Basically, we've gotten rid of using Lasix because I think a lot of medics were giving it incorrectly. They'd hear something in the bases, and I think the issue was it was maybe a pneumonia issue, and they were giving it, and now it's drying them out more. The big advent to CHF patients has been CPAP, or continuous positive air pressure, pre-hospital usage of it. So I tell you, I don't know of another treatment that's come out in the last 10 or 15 years, maybe even, that has had such a positive effect on patients. Like, I remember before that, you remember what they were like? I mean, they'd sit bolt upright, and you're pushing, you're trying to give everything. You're trying to do positive pressure with a bag valve mask. You're given, you're given Lasix, maybe morphine. You're given nitro, and they're like, and you're just watching them crump. But when you put on the CPAP mask, I mean, I've had them where they look like they're on death's doorstep, and by the time I pull up to the hospital, they're sitting there talking in full sentences. I mean, it's almost like, should we really be going code 3 back to the hospital? they seem fine, you know. But they've gotten rid of, you know, they've gotten that CPAP is incredible. But, you know, they're starting to take more and more protocols away from us, different drugs, and I mean, they're even getting away from doing intubations now because people keep missing them. And again, I think it just comes down to people aren't getting trained enough. They're not getting.
So, yeah, see, we were trained to do endos.
Yeah.
But we were using esophageal. We had to go the esophageal way.
We're using something that's called a King tube that basically does the same thing. It's a blind intubation. You stick it in there and you inflate the cuff, and it sits in the esophagus, and then you just keep that airway, the pharynx.
As long as someone doesn't
open.
Try to pull that out without deflating it, and I've seen that happen.
Yep, it just, in fact, happened to a guy I know at work. The guy said, I don't know what this thing is. I've never seen it. Once they got to the hospital, and they pulled it. And luckily,
you don't use mask trousers anymore, right?
Don't use mask trousers, no. In fact, I've never used them. I've taught
I
them.
I did.
But and
I did, and we saved the guy's life with them until the doctor at the ER, where they brought the thoracic man down, and he was arguing with the ER doctor about he couldn't hear the lung sounds because we had those pants on him, and the ER doc was trying to explain to him we had to get him to the OR immediately, you know, and the cutoff part of the descending aorta, so that, you know, because once we drop these pants, he's going to go into shock.
He's done,
He said to the doctor, he says, I'm the staff doctor, you're not. I want these off.
Oh, that makes sense. Jesus.
Soon afterwards, the guy was saying, I can't breathe, gone.
Done.
Yep.
It's so frustrating.
Pissed me off. I was so angry that day.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I would have been...
So multiple stab victim. He had a very weak pulse. He had hardly any BP.
Yeah.
Unconscious. We put those trousers on him. He came to.
Yeah. Well, you shut down everything below his abdomen. I mean, yeah, he's going to stay... I think doctors don't... They're afraid of those, of the mask pants. And I think people weren't putting them on right, and they were taking too long. So it's the training aspect of it, too. And it's a shame because it keeps people alive. I mean, isn't that what we're doing this for? You know, I mean, if people were training in hospitals, that would get rid of a lot of issues. Doctors would become familiar with the equipment. People would have chances to go and remediate in the hospitals. I think there's a real lack of communication between pre-hospital and hospital. And I mean, with Freedom House, having a doctor start something like that, it's invaluable. Having somebody who's thinking about what's happening on the street, the treatments needed to get somebody from the street alive to the hospital is invaluable. And
what was unique about Freedom House is when they first trained, the doctors went with them.
Yeah, right.
So the doctors were exposed
street
to street
medics.
Medicine.
Right, street
so
doctors.
The doctors knew what their Freedom House was up against.
Yeah.
Nowadays, they don't ride with the ambulance crews. So
Never.
They're sitting in a hospital calling you on a radio, having no idea the situation that you're in.
Absolutely. They've never seen it. They don't understand what exactly is occurring on the street. And where is this? All right. If we ran the damn city, Gene, there'd be no problem. What city can we buy right now and just start working on?
You got to look for those little towns when they come up with these oddball things on TV. You can buy this town that has 60 people in a post office
for
$35,000 today.
35 grand. All right. I probably have like maybe $1,400 I got. We can throw into
it. And we'll have to hope and pray that there's a car accident or something on that highway going by there.
Oh, hope.
For work.
All day. Just waiting. No accidents yet? No. Damn it.
You talk about watching grass grow.
All right. So what got you into wanting to do the film?
Well, Well, it's always been my dream about finding out more about these necks, you know, because what happened was when I worked in the ER at Southside Hospital, I'd see Freedom House come in. I used to talk to them, and I asked them about how to join up. I said, you know, I want to be one of you guys, you know, and he says, well, you got to go meet Mitch Brown. You know, Mitch Brown is the guy in charge, and I went over there because there's no such thing as an EMT back in those days, you know.
Right.
None of that was, you know, official, except Freedom House was working, you know, they weren't call paramedics or call like emergency technicians, you know, but you know, because the name wasn't even out yet. And so I went over to Mitch Brown, and there wasn't any opening, so I had to make a decision. And that year in 73, I ended up moving to LA, and I had a job waiting for me at Schaefer Ambulance as soon as I got here, because I had all this experience now, you know. I worked an ambulance for a year and a half. I was still working in an ambulance when I worked at the ER, and then I had 2.5 years in the ER. I mean, I had all this experience now. So, I mean, first day I got here to L.A., they wanted me immediately to go get my uniform, and they wanted me, and the next day I was working.
Nice.
And then I asked for paramedic training, because you got to get sponsored to get there by a company, and they told me in a year or two to give it to me, and I ended up going, so I left, and I went to this other company called McCormick's, and they weren't hiring, so I sold cars for a little bit, and then they called me up and said, hey, we have an opening, you know, work for us for three months, and we'll put you go to school in January. January 1975, I went to the first paramedic training course in Daniel Freeman.
Yeah.
So after that, you know, I always dreamt about Freedom House. I wanted to find out. 75 is when they disbanded, actually, and I always wanted to know more about them. When I got in the studio, I started seeing, you know, making movies about things, and I'd talk to directors and about it and producers, and they said, it's a fabulous story. Because I look at the projects I'm working on were pieces of crap, you know.
I
kept relating to them about the story. He says, it's a fabulous story. And the directors would go, this has got a lot of meat. I would love to direct something like that. But, of course, you know, it's hard to get a project made anywhere. And
absolutely.
So, I ended up writing a story on my own, and then in 84, I went back and I interviewed on tape recorder some of the founders of Freedom House, because they were already gone. So I met the Jerry Esposito. I went and interviewed him in Indiana, Pennsylvania. I interviewed Phil Hallen. I showed them my story. They loved it, and that's what made me, I kept pushing around town, showing my treatment and my story I wrote, and I got option deals. We tried to get it made, and then, like I said, in 2001, I took about $25,000 out of my savings account, grabbed the cameraman, and hightailed it back there and shaked and rattled bushes and shook trees. And I knew one guy, one Freedom House guy, was an assistant deputy chief in the fire, at the paramedics there. And he, you know, gave me an interview, and I kept asking him if he could find anybody else for me. And I didn't let him. I didn't leave him alone. I camped out at his office until he would find somebody for me. I was there every day.
Yeah.
And then I ran around, and the days that I didn't have anybody to interview, I went out and shot B-roll, the city, or I went in and went through files and you know, try to find as much as I could, archival pictures or what I could find of Freedom House. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, man, there wasn't a lot to be found, and the stuff that I did find wasn't even under Freedom House. It was locked up under the different. If you didn't know what the grants were, they were under, you would never find Freedom House.
Wow. Okay. So I mean, it really took some legwork to even just get archival footage.
It took me legwork even after working 7-8 years. I was into the project about 7 or 8 years. And the University of Pittsburgh wanted to put on something for Black History Month. And, and actually, the Vice Chancellor of Media Affairs came out here to L.A. to meet me. And they gave me a little more funds to upgrade the rough cut I had. And they actually opened some doors and found some more materials for me. But that was like 7-8 years later. In fact, even at the NBC station back there told me they had no archival footage at all. But when they need a little piece to put on one of their shows, you know, they found stuff for me within a week.
Of course. Well, yeah, as soon as it suits what they need. But, I mean, yeah, at least you got it. That's the thing. I mean, it just shows what being relentless can finally pay off with.
Plus, you know, the members were really apprehensive of me because they were screwed over. and, you know, the by white people. And, you know, I'm trying to talk to them about interviewing them. Sometimes I had to go, my cameraman's sitting outside, and I'm spending, you know, half an hour to an hour meeting with them to get their trust so I could film them.
All right.
And then when I promised them that, and then the other ones would call up people that they knew after they trusted me, and then I promised them that there was, that I was going to make this thing happen. I was going to tell their story the way they wanted the story told. Then they started dying on me.
Oh, man.
And I ran out of money, and I went and got business loans, and I ran out and used my credit cards, and I did everything I could to keep this thing afloat. You know,
yeah.
I'm just still paying off loans on this thing right now.
It really, I mean, it's interesting that you're getting, you're getting blowback from both sides of the story, you know. It's just, and it makes sense. Obviously, nobody wants to get screwed over anymore, but it really is a testament to just, you know, keep pushing forward, and you do get a good finished product. And I mean, you along the way, you know, it's almost like you were doggedly going after this, but you ended up meeting people that helped you out throughout the process. Like you mentioned before, Thomas Carter, who directed Swing Kids, who did Metro, he did, what else was he doing? Coach Carter. And so
Coach Carter, and he did a lot of TV, Hill Street Blues, an actor on White Shadow, you know, that's how he started.
Oh, okay. And so, I mean, he jumps on.
Basketball show.
Okay.
Yeah, and Thomas, he's won 3 Emmys. I mean, it's the kind of people I have supporting me, you know.
Yeah.
And Terry Kelly, actually was he won an Emmy for Band of Brothers, and he's right now he's nominated for an 80 for Homeland. He's one of the editors on Homeland.
He's editing Homeland right now. Yeah.
Big Showtime Warren wins all these awards. These are the people that have worked on my project. And if it wasn't for Terry, Terry's the one who, I went through 5 editors before we could put this thing together.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want to spend the time because I didn't have money to pay him. But Terry came in, which I owe Terry on the back end, and he made this thing happen. What you're seeing was a lot of Terry's work. I mean, he wanted to know everything about this project. And what really, 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 you know, kind of upsets me is I can't get the distribution deal. This story is so powerful.
Yeah.
Warner Brothers wanted to make a movie about it. It was in development here. And I can't get a distribution deal on this documentary. Yeah. I don't know what's going on here, you know? And then I write letters to the NAACP, to the national branch, the LA branch, every branch I can, but it's coming from a white person. Mm-hmm. So I'm stuck between a rock and a hard spot. I have a black project, but I'm a white director-producer that made it happen.
Yeah.
You know, so I can't get any longevity from the African-American society to push this project, you know? So it sits in a standstill. Even though we packed the house at the Roxy Theater and standing room, and, you know, everybody sees it is blown away from it. Everybody hears the story is blown away from it. Nominated for an HBO award out of 4 documentaries in an entire film festival. And one of the documentaries I was up with was Freedom Riders, who produced by PBS in Boston, who's done by a big-time documentarian.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm right there with him.
Well,
and I still don't have a distribution deal for this.
This
show?
That's the thing I keep telling you, too. I mean, I told you this before. Honestly, the story sells itself. The work you've done is not going to go unseen and unrecognized. And you're pulling people in right now that see the merit in it, and they're talented people. And again, you're going after the Roxy here. You're bringing this film directly to Washington, D.C. as well. And, I mean, it's got legs right now. I think it's only a matter of time here. It's only a matter of time before this thing really pays off and everybody gets a chance to see it.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the other thing we missed a point on is David Page, the EMS educator, mm-hmm. who helped start a program similar to Freedom House in Minneapolis, St. Paul, mm-hmm. which we went down there. He invited us down, and they brought some of the members, and we actually put 5 inner-city classes together. These inner-city EMTs, and they were getting paid minimum wage to go to school. Some of them couldn't even make it to class because they had nowhere to live.
Oh.
They wanted to come, but they had nowhere to live.
Mm-hmm.
They were homeless.
Yeah.
The one guy actually broke into the firehouse where they did the training, was living on the roof. He didn't want to tell anybody because he wanted to make sure he got through the training.
Unreal.
When I met Dave, he had 5 classes, and he couldn't get any of them hired on the fire department or anywhere, except one girl got a job as a secretary because she had an EMS back, an EMT background.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we went down there and brought the Freedom House members, a few of them, and they actually named that fire station after Freedom House.
Okay.
And we went to the graduation. We spoke at these boardroom tables with all these ambulance companies and EMS companies and public safety companies and all of us and showcased these Freedom House, what Freedom House did, to give these kids a chance. And basically, after we left, the fire department started their own BLS, and they have them actually doing it out of the firehouse, and they're doing transports now. And we put 16 to work, and now it's gone up even higher, and they're getting paid minimum wage. And it was done through, you know, the stimulus money.
Okay.
Done through stimulus money. They wear fire department uniforms, but they're strictly, you know, BLS, and they do mostly hospital transports as they're putting themselves through paramedic training and getting paid minimum wage.
Well, so if anything, this film, it's not maybe doing what you'd like as far as, you know, getting it into film festivals and shown, but it's the merit of it alone is getting positive things happening in the world. I mean,
oh yes, that's incredible. We're proud of that. In fact, I tried to do that in Pittsburgh, but since I'm not there and I had meetings there and we did it over the phone and conferences, and it never did happen, you know. Uh-huh. But this is something that can happen a lot of places.
I think so. And it seems like the more you show this, the more positive effect it's really going to have.
And that's one thing I would really love to be involved in. I love to have a nonprofit where we actually bring these and get there. Because I'm an inner city kid.
Oh.
Had I not been from the Marine Corps, I joined at 17 years old, I don't know where I would have been.
Yeah.
You know, I did that under necessity because I didn't want to grow up in that area. I wanted out of there big time. You know, and had it not been for that, like I said, I don't know where I would have been, where I would be today.
Well,
you know?
I know, and I mean, the importance of just teaching anybody this information, it really doesn't know race, it doesn't know religion, it doesn't know gender. I think anybody who learns the basis of medicine and emergency care, the information that you get doing the job, it will help you deal with your family emergencies, it gives you a sense of pride about your work, and, you know, I said, I teach at the City College, too, and it's just amazing to see these kids that have never had a real job before or actually studied anything before get engaged in the information. And it's just because it's incredible stuff. And it's the first time they're actually challenged and they feel up to the challenge to do it. And I mean, really, that's what you're doing this film shows that it's accessible to anybody. You know,
well, the 24-minute piece that I'm going to show,
yeah,
I actually showed to some inner-city kids to get them to take a CPR and a first aid course.
Getting fired up.
Through a friend of mine, Greg Viss, up in Albany, New York. I let him show it, and they couldn't believe it. When they saw that 24-minute piece, which I'm going to show at the San Francisco Paramedic Association.
Right, right.
You know, my regular documentary is 80 minutes. This is like the 24-minute talking head thing. They were blown away.
Yeah.
And that they wanted to take that course even more now, and they ended up getting their CPR and first aid training.
That's great. I mean, you know? You got to be so. I'm amazed. I'm blown away by what this film is doing for society.
And if you go on my website, www.freedomhousedoc.com, there's you can see that part with those kids. They interview those kids that Greg actually shot. That it's. There's a little part in there, one of the links in there that talks about it. I think it's Freedom House Revival or something like that. Yeah, Freedom House Revival. You'll see that.
And
they're blown away.
Yeah, I everybody who's listening, go check it out. www.freedomhousedoc.com.org.
Yes.
.org.
And yes, it's Freedom House, you know, Freedom House, FREEDOM, and then dot. I mean, Freedom House Doc, DOC.
It's like documentary. Right.
And then, yeah, sure, for documentary. And then when you go there, there's also a Facebook link. They'll take you to the documentary Freedom House Street Saviors. And there's a lot of information about what happened down in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and what's going on at the Roxy and what happened at the Roxy previously and what happened at Ball Theater. It has all the events. The Facebook site I started in April, so it has a lot of the history of Freedom House is in there, and everything, all the events that are going on currently are in there, too.
That's huge.
So
okay.
Find all that out, too. And like my Facebook site. Please get up there and tell your friends and get as many people as you can. And I want this thing to go viral if I could, you know.
Everybody.
But it's not something that's – I don't have some guy doing a Macarena or whatever the heck he does out there.
Yeah, Gangnam Style?
Viral.
No, I hear you.
Gangnam Style.
Yeah, you could have like a guy doing a seizure. You could have Grandma
Style. Maybe I need
Grandma
to get
style.
Someone like that on the beginning of my stuff. Then they'll see. Then I'll just sit through it.
That's all it takes. We got to get somebody from Korea. Come on. Let's go shop around. We'll find him in that town we're working in.
That's right.
Yeah,
that
be the guy he's going to dance. He'll be some guy who's doing, you know, dancing at the gas station or something. Put him in the beginning of the show. Perfect.
That's right.
Gene, thanks so much for being on this podcast. Again, guys, get out there, make this viral. Go check out the movie. It's playing at the Roxy the 26th of February this month, and then the 27th they have the 24-minute director's cut. San Francisco Paramedic Association is putting that on. So get out there, check it out on Facebook. Yeah, go ahead.
If anybody comes to the GEMS, the General Emergency Medicine's Conference, the EMS Today in Washington, D.C., we're going to be honoring the Freedom House members at the keynote on March 7th, and at 5:30 that evening, we're going to be showing the documentary Freedom House Street Saviors at the convention.
Get out there, everybody. Make a trip out. If you're living in Baltimore, wherever you are, you know, Virginia, get into D.C., check it out. It's going to be it's a worthy cause. It's a great story. It's something I've never heard before, and it's a travesty that it hasn't been told. So, and again, it's just such a great story and a great documentary. Gene Starzensky, thanks so much. It's been an honor and a pleasure speaking with you on the podcast.
All right. Well, thank you, Kenneth.
You take care. And Kenneth Allen signing out. If you got it, use it, everybody. Thanks.
Thinks we're all the mother. Who are they to judge us?
Mother, mother,
simply calls me where I hell on
the mother.
Ooh.